Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. I don't know if there's anyone on the phone, but we do have the phones muted currently. We will have a time at the end of the meeting when people both here in the audience and on the phone can ask questions, so I will unmute the phones at that time. But until then, you probably won't be able to communicate with us, so I apologize for that. This is the second Fiscal Advisory Committee meeting for the Permanent Colored Art Glass Rulemaking. This is meeting number 2 of 2. And I'll talk just a little bit more briefly than the last time to give an introduction about what the meeting's about and everything. But I can probably go through that quickly because we don't have too many people in the room. So as you know, DEQ proposed and EQC, the Environmental Quality Commission, approved back in April some temporary rules to limit the emissions from colored art glass manufacturers. So EQC approved those in April, and because they're temporary rules, they expire after 180 days. DEQ is planning to propose to EQC that we make those rules permanent. So this is all part of a rulemaking process where, again, we plan to propose that to EQC. So because of the permanent rulemaking, DEQ needs to estimate the fiscal impact of that rule. And then we've called together this committee to review and to make recommendations that fiscal impact statement. So this committee meeting is really just about the numbers, more or less, like about those impacts. Is the estimate correct? And also some questions about small businesses and what we could do to limit the negative impacts on small businesses. There's a bigger part of the public process where there'll be a public comment period that starts next Wednesday. So after this meeting, I'm going to assimilate the comments from the committee. There's already a summary of the last meeting, the minutes from last meeting, where I tried to summarize what I heard from the committee last time. So I'll ask you guys if there are parts of that that I didn't get right or that I missed. I'll do the same thing for this meeting and assimilate those and put that into the package that gets sent out on next Wednesday to start the public comment period. So the public will be able to see summary of the comments that you made, and as DEQ will assimilate those, we may take your advice, we may not, but we'll acknowledge, at the very least acknowledge what you said about our fiscal estimate. And then at that time, when the public comment period opens, then everyone, including the members of the committee, can comment on any part of the rule, including they can comment on the fiscal analysis part, they can comment on the conditions in the rule and everything. Preferred way to make those comments is through a comment tool that we'll post to our website on that day. So if you go the day before, you're not going to see it, but if you go after we've opened public comment, you'll see a tool where you can enter your comments and see what other people have commented. And if you choose to comment that way, that helps us because it makes it easier for us to track all the comments and make sure we're not forgetting some or. It's also acceptable to give us comments by email or other. We'll have a public hearing that will be here. It's tentatively planned for Tuesday, July 19th. And Amanda, I think you requested that it be in the evening, which I was planning to do. So it's going to be probably 6 p.m. I haven't set the exact time. But that is maybe if we have it at night, more people will be able to participate and say what they want to say.
Here in this room?
I find it here in this room. Yeah. So that's not finally yet. We'll send out some more information on our email list and post it to the rulemaking. But I'll probably send notice to all of you if you know. You'll probably know. So we've got the public comment period, the public hearing. Public comment period closes on July 29th. That's a Friday. So. Everyone hopefully has made their comments during that period. We will take a look at those and kind of consider all of those comments. We can make changes to the rule at that point, our proposed rule, depending on what we see in the comments and what we think can improve it. And then we'll bring a proposal to the EQC in October, probably the week of October, the date for that EQC.
So, obviously there's the public comment period. Now, when it comes to you're saying that they could change what they're proposing as a permanent rule at that time that has really maybe sort of the same as the temporary rules, but there could be some add-ons that when that goes to the EQC, that there will be changes potentially, right?
It could be, that's right, yeah.
Okay.
Part of the idea is, like, during the public comment period, maybe someone comes up with an idea, like, oh, it really should be this way, this would be a more efficient way to get at the goals mm-hmm. of this rule. Or they can say, oh, there's this mistake you made when you drafted this, you really should have said this. And so in response to that, we can consider those and agree to those if.
And so knowing that there is a public comment period, how is that sort of deciphered? Like, you know, how is that decided? I mean, is there, how many people are involved in that process? You know, as you guys are looking at the comments, I mean, obviously, you know, as I look through the comments, there's a lot of, you know, there's both ends, obviously, people that didn't want the temporary rules, people that did. How does that actually, you know, really get sort of decided, I guess? And this is just, you know, I think all of us would like to know that process of how are these rules actually, you know, being put into place and who's sort of making those decisions and what, you know, the regulation should be or that.
Arm wrestling.
Mud rest.
Me or Jill, right?
Yeah. And Jill's quite strong. So
it's kind of like how we took comments on the temporary
yep.
rule. I mean, we made some pretty radical changes to what we proposed to the commission. Was it in March? At least April? When did we first go to the commission? Then we took 2 weeks of comment, right? And then we came up with the tier one and tier two.
Yep.
So it'll be like that. Basically, it's going to be the rulemaking team working on the rules, like, you know, looking at the comments that we got and trying to figure out which ones would improve our rules. You will see what those rules are about a month before we go to the commission.
Right.
We send the package to the commission 1 month ahead.
Okay.
And that's when we send it
to
everybody.
So you don't prep to see a draft of it and look at it before you send it?
We usually don't do that, but
just to make sure you get it right.
I don't know.
Are there industry leaders at all involved in, like, you know, just other industries as well that might be giving input based around the permanent rule, you know, process at the end here, like as it's being proposed? Are there industry leaders, or is it just sort of internally DEQ?
In the past, we've taken input from everybody, including, you know, the industry leaders and the public and environmental groups and everybody.
Okay.
And we just kind of sift through all of those and
try to come up with the right decision that
right.
seems to work for everybody, I guess, right? That's sort of what we're saying? Okay. All right.
So Jill, if I understand what you said a moment ago, approximately mid-September is when EQC would see that?
Yes.
So is it safe to assume that you and EQC are in some back and forth communication through that month such that in the actual meeting that would occur in the middle of October, you're not at risk for EQC saying, nope, we're not doing this, go back to the drawing board? And the reason that I ask specifically is because based on this timing, right, we could find ourselves back in no man's land where the temporary rule has expired. And I even as a manufacturer, I think that would be a really bad situation for us to all find ourselves in. So I'm just wondering about the having this occur so late, essentially coincident with the expiration of the temporary rule, if there isn't some way to maybe bring that up so that if EQC wants to push back on something at all, there's time to loop that in before the rule expires, temporary rule expires.
Please. A little bit, yeah. So that's a really good point. And to be clear, the EQC can do whatever they want at that
sure.
moment. And you know, every once in a while, there are surprises. But typically, a process would be to get it to them a month in advance. That's partly why, is to, you know, hurry up and make sure we get it to them so they have enough time to review. And then sometimes the commissioners have questions on what the rules mean, and they ask us those questions in advance. And I think you know, if there was a severe level of discomfort and, you know, everybody was indicating that this was a bad direction for the department, they would probably give us some indication that they thought we were just way, way off base and that we might want to hurry up and propose something different.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have the ability. It's not like we can't talk to them. We really don't have a lot of back and forth. It's kind of somewhere in between, because really we want their meeting to be the public process where that
sure.
happens.
Sure.
But yes, they would have an opportunity to tell us if for some reason they said, gosh, this final rule is so radically different than, you know, what we adopted for the temporary rule. We really think you've gone astray here, and we want to
right.
talk about that.
Given that, and I appreciate that,
yeah.
Saya, I don't know if it's possible, you know, from a procedural standpoint, but if the EQC, the actual formal public EQC meeting, could get moved up 30 days, then if something were to happen, it would give everybody that 30 days to figure out what to do and hopefully make another pass at it before the temporary rule expires. So I'll just leave that as an observation.
Okay. We got about 1,200 comments during that 2-week period.
Mm-hmm.
We went out to comment on the temporary rule. And it was a lot of work to get
I trust it was a mountain of work.
Actually, that's the hardest part of rulemaking is
yes.
when you respond to comments. It's just all of the public stuff. People bring in all these different ideas, and like, you know, they think of things that we didn't think about. So that's, like, for me, a rulemaking.
Mm-hmm.
So we've left ourselves, you know, from end of July to mid-September to respond to those comments. I think if we could get it done earlier, maybe we could go. I think there is a September EQC meeting.
I think we're actually shooting for potentially September, just to not run right up against that line and all of a sudden you have a couple commissioners sick and we don't have a quorum or something like that. You know, so I think we actually are shooting for a special meeting in September because there isn't one.
Okay.
So I think we would call the commissioners together for a special meeting in September. So we may end up having a little leeway there.
Great.
Good. So I wanted to welcome. I think we have a few new audience members. This is a committee meeting where it's basically just going to be the committee speaking and talking about the fiscal statement until the end, but there will be 20 minutes at the end where if you have questions or if there's people on the phone who have questions or comments, there will be time for that. So I invite you, if you have questions or comments, to raise them.
Tom, just a random question about comments. Like other comment kind of processes, you know, name, address, kind of all of those kind of fields. And part of the reason I'm asking is because it was obviously clear last time there was a number of people from other states calling in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not sure, I guess the question goes maybe more to how you consider comment from Oregonians. To whom this rule applies versus folks from Minnesota, et cetera.
Right.
So the people that commented on the temporary rule, you're right, like we had a lot of out-of-state, out-of-country comments. And, you know, basically they were in support of Bullpine. So they got lumped into one category, right? Because they were, you know, a lot of customers. So, and we took, you know, that block of comments, of, you know, it was basically one comment. Support Bullseye, we don't want you to regulate them, you know, that was the gist of those comments that we got. So, you know, to us it doesn't matter whether it's 100 or 500 people, if it's a comment that is applicable to the rule, that would improve our rules, then we'll make the change, regardless of where it comes from. And if you submit it 500 times or you submit it once, it's still a comment. So we don't weight them more based on how many people made the comment, but by the merit of the comment itself.
Okay. So, seems like I'd ask the committee to just very briefly introduce themselves to their name and where they're from.
Yep. Abe Fleischman, North Star Glassworks.
Okay.
Al Hooten, VP of Industrial Operations with Glass Alchemy.
Hi, I'm Amanda Jarman. I'm an organizer with the Eastside Portland Air Coalition.
Chris Winter, Co-Executive Director of the Cragg Law Center.
Eric Duren with Multiply Glass Company.
Jacob Sherman, organizer with the South Portland Air Quality Group.
Paul Troutman, President of Troutman Air Glass.
Great. So this is the second of two meetings here, and at the first meeting, I went through some our draft fiscal analysis, so some spreadsheets and also a narrative. And I've made some changes as a result of new information I've gotten since then, also based on comments from you in previous meetings. So I was thinking that for this meeting, I would just kind of introduce what's different, and you guys are free to ask more questions or make new comments or whatever you might like to do with information. So there were three main changes I made since last time. So I got some, at the previous meeting, for the figure manufacturers, Bullseye and Orboros, I was treating them as a class. I didn't have any facility-specific cost information for the bag house, things like that. So I had one estimate for a Tier 2 manufacturer, one estimate for a Tier 1 manufacturer. And since then, I've got some additional information from Orboros and Bullseye, so I had some facility-specific information, so I have facility-specific estimates now. That was one change. Another change is that so we talked about last time that the cost of the bag house is one of the key factors in the cost estimate. And we also discussed that at least for Bullseye and Orboros, because they're making changes not only because of this proposed rule, but also because of the federal rule, NESHAP, the Part 6F. And so it's difficult to tell, okay, are they installing this bag house because of this proposed rule, or would they have installed it anyway because of that federal rule? And because so they're both happening at the same time, and because there are different choices they could make as far as how they organize their production, how much you run through which furnace. Basically, I feel like there's not one clear answer to that question. And so to try and have a cost estimate that's meaningful, what I did was I tried to develop a low and high estimate that kind of brackets those numbers. So in this case, I have a bracket on number of bag houses that you attribute just to this rule. So we're trying to estimate cost just for this rule. What did they have to do because of this proposed rule? So for Bullseye, my understanding, you're planning to put in four bag houses at your facility.
You're currently working on installing four bag houses.
Okay. So for this estimate, and based on our conversation earlier, my estimate was that some of those bag houses would have been installed anyway because of NESHAP 6F, but some of them probably because of this rule. So for the low and high estimate, I estimated between 0 and 2 bag houses. 0 and 2 of the 4 wouldn't have been installed except for this proposed rule. So in my calculations, I have a multiplier of 0 and a multiplier of 2, and those are both kind of included in that.
Is there any chance that the EPA could give us some clarification so that we can really understand? Because, I mean, I don't think I'm quite wrapping my brain around why are we not clear on how many bag houses would be required under 6F?
It depends on the size of the furnace, if it's a 50-ton per year furnace.
Can everybody speak up, please? It's hard to hear.
Okay, sorry. It depends on the furnace, the production level for that furnace, and if they want to more furnaces to one bag house, it would be one if they put in a bigger bag house, or if they want to do each one individually. So it just depends on what the company wants, how much room do they have, how they want to set it up. That's why it's unknown. It just depends on their configuration.
Okay. Thank you.
So I wonder, Eric, if you might be able to clarify a little bit, because the comment, I guess, in the notes it says that the Bullseye wasn't sure how many furnaces are subject to success. And so I guess I'm just interested in where is the uncertainty in terms of whether success is going to require all the baghouses or not?
It's a fair question. There's a lot of overlap between the temporary rule and the NESHAP 6S. And whereas the temporary rule is focusing on the facility size to establish which tier you belong to,
mm-hmm.
6S is focused on individual furnaces.
Yep.
And within the furnace, you have a choice of the amount of glass that's going to be produced in that furnace and the type of glass that's going to be produced in that furnace. So in our roster of furnaces, we have choices to be made about exactly how that furnace is going to be operated going forward. By September, we'll have a determination of exactly what our intention is as we move forward for compliance with the success plan. So right now, we've been considering historic information.
Right.
Things are changing quite a bit currently, so historic information is a good starting point for that analysis, and that is what we're going through. And then we also have to consider sales demand and plans for future growth as we work through these technical issues.
Okay. So it sounds like you're going to be figuring out between now and September how many furnaces and which ones will be the 50 ton per year or greater furnaces that are subject to the success.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
So I scroll down to basically the result of having this 0 or 2 is that I have a range of estimated costs if we assume that there is no additional baghouses installed because of the temporary rule, and then another range if we assume that there's 2 additional baghouses installed because of the rule.
Joe, looking at your own notes kind of in the tab section, note row 29, you mentioned some furnaces are subject to 6S and some baghouse would be required due to that. I think that estimating one additional baghouse is likely to be accurate. I'd be curious kind of, you know, your estimates kind of played out as sideboards, you know, 0 and 2, but your comment here is kind of reflecting 1, so just be curious your thoughts on that.
Okay. Let's see. Looks like the comment you're talking about is right there, like my notes from talking with Eric.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I guess that's true that I've set up the analysis as sort of sideboards, because that was the best way I could think of to do it. But somewhere in there, there's a central tendency or something. Yeah. Yeah, and maybe I would say that 1 sounds like a good number between 0 and 2. But I don't have additional knowledge that would say that's reliable or accurate. But
maybe just doing that middle analysis and having 0, 1, and 2, having your brackets for all three of those situations instead of just 0 and 2 might be helpful.
Do you feel like that would, I guess for me, like the overall goal of this is to produce an estimate that then I can put in the public notice for like the public to comment on and you can see to comment on. So
a single number.
Well, no, like just whatever result, like for the current narrative, which you guys have a copy of, like I included both of these ranges. Like here's the range of 0, here's the range of 2. But I just wanna, I guess if I put in another number, I'm worried it might make it less understandable to those people rather than more understandable.
I can understand that, but I think that what it does is it provides an opportunity down the road as more information is at hand and we find out, well, it really is 1. Well, then the number's there. There, at least the range is there, right? Or down the road, oh, the number's actually 2. Okay, well, that range is there as well.
Because it sounds like depending on timing of perhaps a special EQC meeting. But if you hold for a September EQC meeting, it sounds like you guys will have more accurate information by September, and so then you could potentially, at least in your presentation to EQC, say, turns out it's one.
Right.
Or it turns out it's two. Or it turns out it's zero.
Yep.
Okay. Okay, I'll think about that. See, so that was analysis for Bullseye. There's similar analysis for Earl Brook. So they're planning to install one bag house that would control the entire facility. And my understanding also is that during 2015, actually all of their furnaces were below the 50 tons per year threshold. So they have a choice. Like they could say, okay, we're gonna make sure that in the future all of our furnaces are still below 50, and therefore we won't have to comply with 6F. In that case, they'd still have to install bag houses because of this rule. So that's kind of on the, okay, one bag house just because of this rule side. On the other hand, I think they are planning to go ahead and comply with NESHAP 6F anyway, because they may want to increase their production above that. So if they do that, they're installing one bag house because of NESHAP 6F, and therefore zero because of this rule. So that's how the zero and one brackets
come about. Any questions or comments? Oh, I have one question. And I thought about this last time but didn't bring it up, but then I saw when you talked to EPA about their cost estimates that the EPA raised it, and that was putting these in terms of annualized costs. So I wonder, you know, if DEQ has thought about that in the past with these fiscal advisory analyses, especially for capital expenditures, whether it makes sense to talk about this in annualized costs.
So you're not talking about costs that are inherently annual. You're talking about amortizing capital outlay
right.
over some schedule, three years, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to make sure I understood your question.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I did, since our last meeting, like, talk with EPA, people who develop the success regulations, so I learned a little bit more about how they do it. And right, they do have a process to take like big capital costs that are kind of one-time things and spread that out as though it were, let's say, a loan over the lifetime mm-hmm. of that piece of equipment. And then you end up with one annual number instead of a one-time number plus an annual.
Right.
Yeah, do you feel like that would be more understandable for the public or a better way to express it?
I mean, my sense is that it better captures the way that the businesses go about looking at these costs. So I would have, you know, that was something that would have recommended last time that it had come up, and it was mm-hmm. something I thought about in advance, and I know that EPA does it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it's something to consider.
I don't disagree with that, Chris, but I would caution against making the assumption that it's the way that most or all of the businesses might approach
mm-hmm.
the aspect of financing this work. So while I think that would be a fine presentation, I would like to see both presentations in the analysis if we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see a one-time plus annual, and then I'd like to see an amortized annual per capital if we're going to do that.
Well, especially for something like us as well, that, you know, actually we're not, you know, taking out financing to, you know, do our install or anything. So obviously for us, we'd like to see just more of the annual breakdown because it is the actual hard cost that we're taking on right now, you know, money that, you know we'd save.
Okay. I guess one part, I think to take the capital cost and annualize them, you have to, I guess, assume an interest rate, and you have to assume what the lifetime of the equipment is. And those are, I guess they use 7% for the interest rate, and I think they use 20 years for the bag house. I don't know if you have information, maybe from your bag house conversations about what the lifetime is.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably each facility is going to be a little bit different. I would think Euroboros and Olvi might have a little shorter life just due to the amount of materials they're going through and how much, you know, particles are actually going through there. but obviously I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I know for us, I would say, you know, we're thinking at least through Cervico and what we've done, a good 30-40 year run. And it's really, you know, if you're not taking care of the equipment, you're, you know, letting build up in there and not cleaning up where stuff's going to start corroding the metal bag house. But I'd say a good 25 to 30 years, or at least us.
But you're talking about through the unit as a whole as opposed to the filters?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the filters
require some maintenance, and yet they have to be operated properly to last longer, and you know, motors and other equipment do break down and have to be maintained or replaced. So I don't know if you take that into account in 30 years or not.
Well, I would just say just the bag house itself, not the maintenance of, like, just keeping it up to date, the cleaning or anything like that. I mean, we already know no matter what, you're going to have a, you know, bags that are going to be replaced, no matter if it's once a year or once every 5 to 7 years. You know, I mean, from at least what we think in our operation, we're going to be looking at anywhere from 5 to 8 years before we have to replace filters. And it's a process, obviously, of cleaning the filters and making sure that you're not contaminating them with vapors or gas.
You know, I'd say considering that the bag houses do need to be replaced eventually, that Al's suggestion that we look at both the one-time cost but then also an amortized figure makes sense, because we assume then this really is an addition to these manufacturers' cost of doing business in perpetuity. So even if it has to be replaced in 30 years, well, let's take that full cost and divide by 30, interest rate, et cetera.
Okay. That would assume that somewhere in one or another state agency, you guys would have access to finance economists, right, that could let you know how to approach this kind of an analysis in a way that's relevant currently and defensible and all. I mean, I assume somewhere our tax dollars are buying that kind of expertise in state government.
Unfortunately, it's not a DEQ, unfortunately. We've had a conversation with Jill before. We don't have an economist on staff at the agency. But,
wouldn't that be great?
It would be. EPA might be able to help somewhere else in the state.
Somewhere
government.
Else in the state. Yeah. I didn't figure DEQ did.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the state.
EPA certainly has economists on staff.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually did talk to an EPA economist who worked on success stuff. So
yeah.
If all failed, perhaps that person would be willing to check out our calculations.
Probably takes that person about 5 minutes to run the counts, is my guess.
Probably.
Right. If they're a finance economist.
Yeah.
So some other kind of accounts. Yeah, it'll be fast.
Okay. Let's see. Eric, I was wondering, this is kind of your first opportunity to make comments on the calculations. I don't know if you had any thoughts you wanted to share.
Thank you. I think that they're fine estimates. They are estimates, and actual experience will show the true costs as we move forward. And again, as we march through our process of addressing both temporary rule and success, other pollution control devices may be necessary. But I believe this is a realistic set of numbers that you've assembled.
A question for you, Eric. On your cost per control device, it shows a total annual cost per bag house of $27,000 to $87,000. Is that for just maintenance of the bag house, or is that actual for the filters that you guys expect to be replacing as you guys are operating?
I believe that's assuming all costs in.
Okay.
That's like adding up a couple of the columns that are above there. So I think those are actually numbers that I've gotten mainly from the tier one folks. The 15 to 70 for the annual operation, and then the 12 to 17 for the cost of the monitor report.
Okay.
So just adding up those.
Yep.
I have a question about the source testing costs. So I'm just wondering, Eric, if this number is 60 to 65 is based on the source test that you ran recently. And was that a successful source test? Because I don't know if we got the results back. So does that factor include like some retesting or just a one-time source test?
That represents the cost of the source test that was performed in April.
In April.
I can't hear a word that anybody's saying. You, Chris, I can't hear. Mr. Duran, I can't hear.
Your seat's in the front.
The that cost estimate represents the test that was done in April.
In April. Okay. And was that a successful source test?
The test was done, all of the information gathered from the source test was to the DEQ.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Okay. So if we're ready, I was thinking I'd move on to the changes in the narrative. Can we have more comments on the spreadsheet part of it before we do that? Okay, we'll go to that.
Were those the only real changes in the spreadsheet?
Let's see. I think those are the only ones we haven't discussed. So I did make some of the changes that the committee proposed last time. I think like the 12 to 13, I think, was one of those. And then I think proposing that the tier 1 to the back house should be 250 to 400 instead of 300, something like that. I believe those are the only changes, the only big changes to the spreadsheet.
Those were the big ones for tier 1.
Are there other parts you wanted to?
No, I was for my own understanding, curious.
Okay. Well, so for now, let's transition over to the narrative a little bit. You have a copy of that as well. So the major change here, so the comment from the committee last time was that you wanted EQ to try and quantify the health benefits of the rule. So I would say I tried, and then you might say I failed, or you might say I had to punt a little bit. So I looked at, okay, can we estimate how many people are affected, and what are the health impacts we would expect those people to have, and what are the costs of those health impacts? So I was trying to like see if I could put together a whole chain of calculations that at the end could estimate, okay, like we think there are this many dollars in additional health costs and health impacts for the people who are exposed. And, it said decided there were so many of those pieces that I don't know, and that I didn't feel that I could put some incredible together. I did talk with David Ferrer at the OHA, the Oregon Health Authority, who is the, is he a toxicologist? So I look at him as the person who would be able to answer that much better. He said that the OHA is working on an analysis, a public health assessment, for the neighborhood on Bullseye and the neighborhood around Ouroboros. But those won't be ready until late fall, he said. So I think from a deep perspective, or at least from my perspective, like, okay, I'm not gonna make an attempt to do that. I think they are much more qualified, and I think it looks like a long process for them. There's a lot of work that goes into that. So I'm not gonna make my own guess of those numbers. When in late fall when we come out, we can all take a look at that. That's it.
Do you know when OHA is planning to have that analysis available?
So late fall is what they said. Those two analyses.
So it won't be before the permanent rule's in place.
Yeah, I wonder what they mean by late fall.
January.
I don't know. It could be that late fall would mean sometime around September, October. I don't know.
Okay.
But probably not enough time at least for DEQ to really incorporate that into things that we would give to DEQ.
Joe, it's my sense that with taking a look at the economic impact on public health and property values, all of those pieces we talked about, you know, what happens if we don't pass this regulation, that seems like it's a new step for the DEQ. So I wouldn't expect that you would come up with a framework and methodology and do this really intense analysis in just a couple of weeks. So that said, I think that is something that the DEQ should add into this sort of process on a day-forward basis. And you know, knowing ahead of time, how are we going to look at the economic impact on health? And what is the framework for doing that analysis so that you know, somebody like you is not just put in the position of, like, just make something up. So it's great to hear that the OHA is working on that, and it seems like partnering with them sooner rather than later to understand how they're going about that and ideally to turn that project into a pilot for future efforts to understand. That would be really great. And then I have some very nitpicky feedback on one sentence here about the health impact. So where it says health problems have negative economic impacts to the people experiencing them, I'd love that to say something like to the public and employers, because certainly the people who experience those negative health impacts, they can't go to work, they're not making a paycheck, but then their employer is experiencing lost productivity as well because suddenly this person is staying home taking care of their kid with asthma, or they themselves have cancer, or whatever's going on. And then we as the public pay those health costs in terms of if somebody does go to the emergency room and let's say they are a recipient of public health services, or they don't have health insurance and the public ends up putting the bill for that. So just making sure that we know that, yeah, it's a pretty broad impact, economically speaking.
Joe, I emailed you some feedback at 1:40, and I think I kind of addressed some of that same issue, in terms of taxpayers in general, for people who are on Medicare, Medicaid, businesses in terms of lost worker productivity, and then thinking also about municipalities in terms of lost economic development from bad reputations and then real estate values to homeowners. So would just encourage you to think a little bit more broadly than the people instantly breathing the air.
Yeah, I was going to make the same comment. I'd like the narrative to reflect the costs that can be incurred by pollution apart from just the direct health costs. So property values, secondary costs like Amanda was talking about. So if that can get carried forward into the narrative, I think that'll be at least a good placeholder for when DEQ returns to this issue later on.
I think one of the problems with that is that it's going to be so hard to isolate anything that's coming out of glass factories versus what's coming out of cars or metal factories or any other source of pollution and attribute it to a specific source without a whole lot of science that at this point doesn't seem to be happening as far as I know. So.
Any other thoughts on the narrative?
It's in your inbox, but the next paragraph down where I appreciate you including some language about US EPA's kind of methodology that they've used, kind of following the range between 3 and 30, I suggested via email, and I literally just cut and pasted it from EPA's website because I think it's good language, but they kind of... About this, they say EPA calculated a net improvement in economic welfare because cleaner air leads to better health and productivity for American workers, as well as savings on medical expenses for air pollution-related health problems. The beneficial economic effects of these two improvements alone are projected to more than offset expenditures for pollution control. I plagiarized it. I want to be clear about that.
nice writing,
Jacob.
I
think it would be useful, again, just as kind of framing language to include.
I second Jacob's suggestion. And also, Joe, thank you for including the EPA stuff in here. That's great.
Okay. Anything else?
I have a couple of other small things. And again, it's in your inbox, but just I think for the sake of transparency. In the start of this section that's titled Public, which I don't know what page I'm looking at, it, not the nicely formatted version. The public decreased emissions of metal hazardous air pollutants and other particulate matter may have significant health benefits. I just kind of took issue with the word may, and I will raise that and let you just decide if you want to use the word will or is anticipated to, but the weakness of that word there particularly stuck out at me.
Okay.
Is there a reason that is in there like that, Joe? I guess that might be another question. Why is it saying may? Is it, that is a question.
Let's see.
If I can add one piece to this, I had that initial reaction to this language, but the sentence before is very specific. The proposed rules are intended to measure and reduce emissions of metal HAPs from the CAGMs subject to the rule. Decreased emissions of metal HAPs, which I'm taking contextually to mean metal HAPs from CAGMs, because that's the context of the prior sentence, and other particulate matter may have significant health benefits for the public. The reason that I ended up okay with the word may in there is because there are many other sources of exactly these same pollutants in the air. And it may be the case that if we completely control the CAGMs, at least in some situations, that we do not that we do not see significant health benefits for the public. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that we don't need to do it. We do need to do it. All the CAGMs need to do this, and we are. But that doesn't take into account the large glass recyclers and the metal, you know, recyclers, all of which are, you know, sending arsenic out and all of the things that we're having trouble with. So if I'm not opposed to changing that language here, but the way it's written right here, I don't think that it is guaranteed that we're going to reap significant health benefits, the health benefits that we want to reap, just from the CAGMs taking the actions that we are under this regulation. So that's where I ended up with it.
I'd be comfortable with something like, is beneficial for public health, because we know that it is. And we certainly know that in my neighborhood, I live 5 blocks from Bullseye, we were able to measure the difference of, you know, particulate matter in the air, particularly with arsenic and cadmium. I mean, the levels were off the charts in October. They're not now.
Not
it's
now.
Because
right.
Bullseye is not using those metals in unfiltered furnaces. So I agree with you, Al, that Bullseye is not the only pollution issue in my particular neighborhood. However, they have been a significant part of the problem. And so I think saying decreased emissions of metal HAPs is beneficial for public health. I think that's a legitimate and accurate thing to say.
And I completely agree with that.
Okay. Yeah, I can see like a way to rework that to say more. Here's, I guess, so I don't have that OHA report, and so I don't know if that report's going to say, wow, we were able to say because of these emissions from the civic facilities, you know, we can identify directly these really big problems. But they're going to say, well, we can't really identify that. But we can definitely, I think, say like that these emissions lead to higher concentrations around those facilities. So I could see reworking this to say more about the things we do know.
And in the flip side is, in our situation, we have two huge polluters. We're flanked by two huge polluters on either side that, as much as we've tried to have the conversation, I don't know that anybody's looking at them. And they, by hundreds of times, far outshadow the kinds of emissions that we could do out of our little facility. We're doing everything. We're installing bag houses. We're doing, now that we have the science, we're doing everything that we need to do because we want to. But at the end of the day, I doubt that monitoring equipment in our area is going to show that we've addressed the majority of the air quality problem.
Right, which is why it's beneficial, but significantly, like, we're all going to feel better because Al's got furnaces filters, migraine birthday.
Right, yeah,
I take your point very much.
So, I'm using it a little bit as a lever, again, to try to get the agencies that are involved here to actually look at these other polluters in the area. But that's a different conversation.
On that note, I agree that, I think all of the colored art glass manufacturers, want to see the DEQ looking at all the sources and not just focusing on us because of the public outcry, but because there's so many more sources of pollution out there. And we feel like we're sort of right now, we're sort of like the scapegoat. Not that we don't want to do what's right. It's just that there's so many other sources that probably aren't getting looked at in such detail right now. And after we all have our baghouses in, I don't think that people can just relax and think that their quality is going to be so much better, at least, everywhere in town.
Absolutely. You guys are the tiniest tip of the iceberg. A toxic tip, indeed. But there's all other stuff out there, like the diesel trucks, for example. So, yeah, and I think we're right behind you guys, and, like, let's address the bigger picture. So that's great.
I don't know. I guess I'm not familiar with facilities near your facility, but did you want to mention the names of those two? Or
not on the record during the meeting, but I'm happy to have that conversation after.
Okay. All right.
There are people at DEQ who have had this conversation with me and are very aware.
Okay.
The only other suggested change that I bring up is the top of page 2. It is possible that Bolden may be able to offset the cost of compliance through increased prices. The Portland Mercury wrote a story 2 days ago, I believe, talking about how Bullseye is increasing prices by 12.5% across the board in order to offset cost of installing new filters. So I think it's a factual piece that's important to include in the fiscal statement.
Okay.
I think then you also have to include the fact that there are Chinese competitors out there that don't have to comply with any of these rules at all, who we are also competing with. And so if we raise our prices, that gives them an opportunity to come in and undercut us even more than they already do. So, you have to take that into account as well.
Also, price increases don't necessarily translate to increased sales. We have a diminishing return. So it is possible, but it is not a guarantee.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I think that just, again, for EQC getting the materials in front of them to have that, possibly with some of that context of the unknown how this increase will impact sales, I think it's just important for that decision-making authority to kind of have that information.
All the information is.
And Paul, do you know if are there competitors within the United States or other countries that do have, is it only China that you're looking to in terms of competition, or has Oregon kind of been like the last place that you could make glass without pollution controls? And so now that we have pollution controls, there's nowhere else in the U.S.
Well, I'm not completely aware of what else is, required in different states. There are small companies coming online that compete with us now that are, they start small and then they get bigger. The Chinese, the Indians, I don't know who else.
That's pretty much it. And we're like under attack right now. As a colored glass manufacturers, we are, as us being tier 1 to 3 sort of big guys out there, we are definitely under attack. Got China coming on strong, and obviously seeing these regulations coming on us. And I'm sure Bullseye and Euroboros are going to be experiencing sort of the same thing, with these regulations being tough for us to, deal with. You're going to see a lot of other companies trying to get it. Obviously, we're here for a reason as well. We manufacture great products, and we know how to do it. Other countries have tried, other companies have tried, but it's not making it that easy when we have a lot of these little thorns that do not.
Just this last week, the Chinese knocked off a couple of my colors and are starting to market them at half the price of what
they do. Those are all real problems, but I'd like to point out it's not just overseas, it's actually in Oregon. One of the unintended side effects of this rule that we're beginning to see indications of is people taking the threshold the minimum production threshold for applicability of the rule, and specifically starting to melt glass in their garage or, you know, some warehouse down the street, whatever, wherever they are, specifically doing so under that limit because they know that they won't be subject to the regulation. And there are dozens of these, dozens, just in Oregon, that are starting up. And they're going to compete with the three of us, at least. I don't know about soft glass market, but the borosilicate market, we're already seeing dozens of these. And it's going on across the country. It's going on across the country. And my concern is that we are going to accidentally see air quality get significantly worse, specifically in residential neighborhoods, because that's where this is happening. It's happening in people's garages. It's happening in their back bedrooms, right? And they're not subject to these regulations. And we've already communicated with the DEQ to ask them to, if possible, given, you know, limited resources, to pay attention to this growing problem, too. I honestly think that from a business management perspective, those operations are going to be the largest thorn in our side as borosilicate manufacturers.
And maybe that's something that we can think about adding that to the actual permanent rules, obviously, if they're elected, is having a lower volume, you know, of glass being produced, because obviously we're all going to be complying to what is going on. And why limit it to this, you know, this number of pounds produced when you might have a guy in, like Al saying and Paul saying, guys in their pretty much their garages using a dryer hose to try to filter a furnace that's melting, you know, hazardous materials. And obviously they're not going to be polluting the whole, you know, community, but they are going to be polluting their neighbors. That, you know, these guys are paying their employees cash. They don't deal with OSHA. They don't deal with, you know, payroll. These are all things that, you know, like I said, we're under attack right now. And, you know, like I was saying, it's a perfect opportunity for any of these small little guys to buy a few of these little furnaces, you know, quickly plug them into their dryer plugs, and all of a sudden they've got a semi-small manufacturing facility that's competing with us. And obviously business is business. This is America. But I would think if the permanent rules are going into place, you know, we have no objection, at least from Tier 1, that those smaller people should be at least looked at, or at least some form of, you know, pounds that go way down to 500 pounds a year.
So just a couple questions for you guys. When you said, Al, that people were coming in under the threshold to avoid regulation, did you mean folks in Portland were coming in under the 10 ton per year threshold, or folks other places
all
around the country,
country
were coming in under 50 tons per year? To
Both.
So one thing that I think is important on this topic, one is for the permanent rule for CAGMs to apply statewide.
Yes.
So I still don't understand why it's a Portland-only rule, which incentivizes your competitors to just move outside of the Portland area and set up shop and be able to produce 10 to 50 and go unregulated.
Or even someone like us, you know,
right,
decide, look, we don't want to be in Portland anymore.
So
we're going to move down to Eugene.
So I still never understood why it was just a Portland area rule that creates an incentive for someone to just change locations and avoid regulation.
Is that true? I thought it was a Portland-wide.
Is the temporary rule is just for Portland, and
what about the permanent rule?
And the plan is to keep it the same so far.
Greater Metro,
right? So I think that's something for you all to carry forward into your comments on the permanent rule.
Yeah.
Really encourage DEQ to make this a statewide rule, because it really doesn't make sense for someone to be able to move out to, you know, Hood River, wherever, and just escape regulation.
I think even for the purview of this committee, I think it fits within that in terms of thinking about the fiscal impact of this. I mean, the incentives that are being set up, and I think it's relevant to this conversation as well.
Right.
Would love to see it reflected in the comments.
Do we know, maybe this is a question for Jill, do we know why it was just the sort of Portland localized area and not like the whole state?
I'm not positive. I think it was because we had the monitoring data here.
Mm-hmm.
Although we don't have monitoring data for, you know, Tier 1, we do have Tier 2.
You will.
Right, right. or maybe we know that, or at that time, that knowing that all those glass companies were actually here in the Portland sort of area, and that's why they left it there, because they couldn't find anybody else down in Eugene in this large volume, or, you know, I mean, would that be fair to say, maybe, that it was, because obviously we were all identified before the temporary rules even, you know, started.
If you're expanding or intended to capture smaller producers, there may be also a question about how that would affect glass blowers who would be melting glass from batches.
Yeah, that is a great idea.
There's other sources of glass production.
Yes, we've had a lot of phone calls, obviously, from glass blowers in town, actually phone calls that DEQ has made to them with concern, and I'm sure it's been raised by neighbors or, you know, public that, you know there's a glass shop that's blowing glass or something like that. And obviously they've called DEQ thinking they are a tier one or a tier two manufacturer. So it definitely has sent a scare, a ripple out there. I don't know if you guys have received any of those same type of phone calls, but we have. So, but I do agree with you on that, Eric, that, you know, I guess that would be cautious of how that is actually looked at, because, you know, we do have artists here that, you know, do work in their garages and have these small little shops, and obviously we wouldn't want to have them fold them into, you know, a semi-manufacturer.
It seems like there's a really large gap between my nephew is a glass blower, to put that out there, so I have a picture of what the little furnace looks like. It seems like a really big step from, like, what my nephew's doing in his parents' garage to manufacturing 9 tons per year of colored glass, which it sounds like people can come in under that 10-ton and compete directly with you and pollute their neighborhood. Does that make me comfortable?
To your point, and this is where I'm concerned as well. The footprint of that pollution may not be so big, but that pot in your nephew's garage could be melting cadmium, could be melting hexavalent chromium with no controls, and it may only be the next three houses down the street
get
cancer, but, right?
Agreed.
So, you know, I would be hypocritical to sit here and tell you that I don't have a business competition perspective on this. I do. We're a business. I would not deny that. But that's not the driving reason for this comment. I'm greatly concerned that there can be a side effect of this rule that will cause people, because what people do, to figure out how to go and bring these operations up, because they right now they can't buy the product they want from Troutman Art Glass, North Star, or Glass Alchemy in the borosilicate market. None of us are making it because we have the science now. The control systems aren't in. Until the control systems are in, we have all chosen voluntarily, even though the temporary rule would allow us to use these materials until October 1st, we have made the decision not to, which means our markets are not being served. Those people, those glass blowers, those torch workers, they're going to go try to find that glass somewhere, and if they can get it from their buddy in the next town over who's got three pots plugged in his garage, polluting his neighborhood, they will.
And I think the point is that that's the economic impact to us.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I see one of the issues here is, you know, at what point are you going to cut it off? Because besides glass people, you know, there's potters out there who make glazes. What is glaze? It's kind of a glass that you coat ceramics with. And people use the same basic chemicals that we do in glass. And, you know, maybe the volumes are low, but there may be some ceramic manufacturers in the Portland area who are also, you know, are they being monitored as well?
Yeah.
People, you know, who do welding. You know, welding fumes put off a large amount of chromium and other kinds of harmful vapors. I bet if you found out how many people have welders in their garages in the Portland area or in the state, that, you know, there'd be, you know, thousands and thousands of them. And those things all add up. So, you know, at some point, though, you have to decide, you know, how small of a person you're going to go after. And DEQ has limited resources, too. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly how you would manage this, so.
Based on raw material manufacture instead of glass blowing so it doesn't, or fusing or slumping so it doesn't actually eat those people up into it, I don't know.
Is it true that some people only work with, I guess, glass that's already been fused together?
Yeah.
And other people, like, make the batch from just powders and stuff like that, is that right? It seems like the, I guess, I'm not sure I have a clear understanding of how it all works, but it sounds like there's an initial process where you're putting these powders in, and that's maybe where more of the emissions come in, you're fusing all that together in the glass. And then your consumers, like when they're using that glass, it's already fused, there's not really a lot of emissions in your email.
Not as much.
It depends on the temperatures they're taking it to, though. It greatly depends on the temperature.
So once the chemicals are in the glass and melted for a period of time, the amount of emissions that come off are much, much smaller than when you're basically making the glass from other materials.
But some of the people operating in the garages that we're talking about are starting from the powders and doing that initially.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We refer in the industry that's melting for batch.
I think it's probably
referred
batch.
To.
Although the three of us primarily melt from pre-made glass rather than from raw materials like some of the other glass companies, luxury glass companies. So the emissions are smaller from that kind of operation as well, if the fact that we use electric.
I guess these are the kinds of comments that would be really helpful like during the public comment period as well, like especially, I guess the question I would have is, like, is it feasible for the rule to incorporate some kind of restrictions for facilities like that that are really small, like ideas for, okay, are there ways we can estimate how many of those there are, ways we can estimate what their emissions might be, ways we can think of, like, what could DEQ feasibly try and require the really small operations to do. Definitely would be, I would expect, to be difficult to enforce small entity. The more difficult it is for DEQ to require them to do something that they may not want to do. But I'd be interested in ideas on how we could go about that.
Well, what we're trying to do as a complete effort here is make positive advances in air quality, in a particular, especially in residential neighborhoods, but overall. It seems to me that if the minimum threshold of applicability were brought way down, even 1 pound, effectively meaning everybody is affected by the regulation. We know that DEQ does not have the resources to go out and enforce that in every garage in the state of Oregon, right? But I would make a guess, and it is just a guess, that doing something like that with the minimum threshold of applicability for the permanent rule would cause 90% of the people that are out there that might consider doing this to not do it, whether they see enforcement action coming down their street or not. The mere fact that the rule would include all of these folks might have a significant positive impact on air quality due to the types of reasons we've been talking about over the last few minutes, even if the resources to do spot-by-spot enforcement aren't available. So just that alone, I think, is a potential advantage.
So I guess just to summarize, I think maybe what I'm hearing is that the committee wants the narrative to recognize that because of the 10-ton per year threshold, the volumetric threshold, and the geographic limitation on the permanent rule, that those components may result in existing manufacturers being subject to competitive disadvantages in the marketplace with fiscal impacts on their businesses.
And negative impact on air quality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that already. I mean, just like...
And human health.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And we've seen that already. I mean, ever since this process started, we've seen a number of small little, facilities pop up that are, sort of using our, voluntarily stopping using these materials to actually take this as an advantage to them. And, obviously, we're a lot bigger than they are. And, it's always a worrisome, especially now that we're all investing these large, investments into our, business. That they've got a competitive edge over us. and you know, they're using it to their advantage, at least over these last few months.
Okay.
All right.
Just
going to tear off on Chinese products.
Woo!
I don't think tariffs are
in my I would suggest, especially, you know, tier one, Bullseye included. I mean, especially around the whether or not the permanent rule is going to be able to make some of these changes that we're talking about. But I mean, if you all just spent the time to write a single letter and submit that as comment, I think that would be incredibly powerful.
I already have once, and we'll do it again.
I think on some of these other points around, you know, international competition, we know as citizen advocates that our federal delegation has been very responsive.
Oh, yeah.
And would encourage you to also reach out to your representatives on some of those issues that, you know, obviously I don't think they're looking for jobs to be lost in the area.
We do provide a lot of jobs.
Yeah, so just encourage you to think about, you know, talking with Senators, you know, Wyden and Merkley. They're thinking about solutions.
Most definitely.
That's a good point, Jacob.
Okay. So, at some point, I want to move over to the four questions. Are you guys ready to do that, or?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. At the very back of the handout, there's the minute. So if you wanted to take a look at the summary I wrote up of the comments on those four questions from last time, you can let me know if I captured the things you're important, if they're important or not. And then, Eric, it's your first chance to weigh on those if you'd like. The first one was, would the proposed rule have a fiscal impact? DQ is saying, yes, we think it will.
I agree, it would have a fiscal impact.
Okay. And our estimate of that impact is reflected in the calculations you saw.
And I believe your estimates are legitimate.
And the DQ also estimated the rule would have a significant adverse impact on small businesses.
It will have an impact on our business.
Okay. I guess small in the context of rulemaking, small is less than 50 employees. So I guess in this context, actually small would refer to the four other businesses.
I believe it will have an impact on the other
businesses. Yeah.
Okay. It will have a significant adverse impact on at least one of them.
Okay. And then the fourth question was, are there ways that you can think of that the adverse economic impact could be reduced?
I'm not aware of any other alternatives to reduce the financial impact.
Okay.
I'm curious, though, with regards to this last question, going back to the conversation that we just had in terms of, you know, ways to reduce the economic impact while still meeting the health goals might include changes to the rule to drop that 10-ton limit down.
Yes.
It seems like that would mitigate to some extent kind of the economic impact while still meeting the public health safety goals.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, to be clear about my last statement, while it will have a significant adverse impact financially, we're all in agreement this has to be done. And it is being done as we speak. And as we get more science in the future and we learn more and more, other things will likely have to be done. And that's all good will happen. The changes or the potential for changes to the rule to increase scope of applicability to the smaller types of operations that we were talking about, I think is a very important type of change or set of changes to consider.
so that significant adverse impact does not become unmanageable.
I think also going to the point that Chris mentioned in terms of the geography of just kind of confined to the Portland metro area, that again, another change to the rule in order to mitigate significant adverse economic impacts would be to increase this to a larger geography. Because as Paul even mentioned last time, you know, to pick up and move a factory isn't an easy thing. And so if everyone or if other manufacturers were playing under the same rules, it would mitigate the impact while still advancing the public health goals of the rule.
If the 10-ton rule was changed and it was just affecting the Portland area, I don't think it would have that big of an impact unless it was expanded to all of Oregon or ideally the entire United States.
Agreed, the small operations would just do whatever they're going to do out there
if they were
outside
ever
of the geographic scope of the rule.
Yeah.
If they were ever found. Right.
We know who they are.
So my question to you is, what would be a better threshold, a lower threshold?
£5.
My opinion,
£1.
£1.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, if you melt, my primary interest, our primary interest here is the health and safety. It's air quality. It's not having an impact on public health. This business has been in existence for 15 years. It's a family-owned business, not my family. And we care a lot about these things. If you make it 10 tons or you make it 5 tons, 5 tons of glass is a lot of glass. It's a lot of glass, it's a lot of money, it's a lot of chemicals. If you're going to let somebody melt and deliver 5 tons of glass out of their garage with impunity anywhere in the state, I think that's a mistake. 1 ton. I think that's a mistake. So yeah, £1 is my answer.
It just becomes a regulatory nightmare at this point. At that point,
it does, and I recognize that. But,
I don't think it would be that
but
bad.
But the fact that you know the an attorney years and years ago once said to me, you know, the fact that a law is unenforceable doesn't mean it's not the law, right? The fact that the DEQ may not have the resources to enforce a rule at 15,000 locations across the state or 50 locations across the state or whatever the number would be doesn't change the fact that there's still the regulation. And a lot of people would abide by it.
Well, what would probably happen in that circumstance, this is something we recommended on the temporary rule, is that if it's a much lower threshold, it creates a certain barrier to getting into the market for manufacturers, and it's only the people that are responsible enough to go through the permitting process and that have enough volume to make that worthwhile are the ones that end up participating in the marketplace. So by setting it that low, I think what that means is that we probably won't have a bunch of guys in their garages at one time, at 1 to 5 to 10 pounds a year. It'll end up being the guys like you all who have already been set up that are prepared to be regulated.
Except there are thousands of people all over the country.
Right.
You know, we're only talking about Portland here, maybe if we're lucky, Oregon.
Right.
And we're obviously biased as well. I mean, obviously in the setting as we're sitting here dealing with these major financial burdens and everything, we're biased, obviously seeing these things happening in our own state, other states where, you know, we are seeing some impact on our business as well. You know, it's almost like kick a mother down type of deal. And, you know, we are down. You know, we're making decisions on our businesses just like Euroboros and Bullseye as well, where it's affecting us. And, you know, we see these little guys right now, and you know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars that are being ripped out of our market,
right,
due to the fact of this right now.
I guess my point is that from the agency's perspective, this threshold and the geographic limitation are going to create more uncertainty and are going to lead to bigger headaches in the future because all the activity is going to shift around, and then DEQ can have to figure out where it all went,
right,
and how to respond to it. Whereas if it's statewide and there's low threshold, then DEQ will know that it's not going to go underground and it doesn't have to be fleshed out. So I'm just saying from the agency's perspective, it helps with certainty if it's an equal playing field.
That's a very articulate way to put that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly our concern.
I'll say agreed.
Okay. I wanted to ask, are there, so like, if someone's making glass in their garage, or what's the phrase that you use there? Something
melting batch.
If they're melting batch in the garage, are there a large number of places where they get those, their supplies, if they're buying the
raw materials?
The raw materials.
There's no regulation on. You can call any company in the state here and order cadmium, China, anywhere. Right?
Okay.
There's no regulation on purchasing raw materials.
Okay.
And they don't have to only be melted batch. They could do what the three of us do in the borosilicate market, start with preformed clear and then add chemicals to the clear as well. So they could do it the way we're doing it. They could do it from batch. That's not really the big question. The big question is, what are the colorant chemicals and the fining chemicals that they add into their pots that they're melting, because it's those chemicals that are that create the problematic emissions.
Okay. I guess I'm just wondering, like, if there were a small number of sources of the colorant chemicals, for example,
maybe
that would be a way to, like, try and...
No,
you could
just get on Amazon and order 50 pounds of
hexavalent chromium.
It's easy to get any of this.
Let's do some crafts this week.
You'd have to pay a lot for it, though.
I'd just be curious about this point of process, where we stand in terms of unanimity on the dropping the threshold, expanding the geography. I think a lot of us have talked about it. I've seen a lot of head shaking, but I think, you know, in terms of whatever gets written into the notes to go forward to EQC, I would be curious if, I don't know, if we want to vote on that or if we want to just say, I don't know. Yeah.
Candace, if you want to.
Well, your process, so I'm just like maybe suggesting.
Yeah, so I guess you're suggesting like that it looks like it might be unanimous among the members of the committee that you would support this rule having a much lower threshold, maybe 1 pound, and also being effective across the entire state, not just Portland.
Well, you have to talk about whether you're talking about producing 1 pound of glass or using 1 pound of HAP chemical.
That's another hot button for me. But I've actually decided to get off that horse because it doesn't appear to be able to get any traction. We should all really, ultimately, the rule, any of these kinds of rules should be written based on amount of material used, but they're not, and it's because I don't know why, but they're not. So we're stuck, I think, with the perspective that the rule should be written based on final produced quantity of glass, regardless of the materials that are in that glass every year. It seems to be where the rule writers are at. So I've kind of let that one go personally, and that's why I'm saying one pound of you produce 1 pound of glass, you have to take
it. Even if it has 1 microgram of a half chemical in it.
Right. That's why I ended up where I did.
And again, you know, I just think that we have to be careful not to get too myopic. If you're going to get down to smaller amounts of pollutants, then we have all these other sources to look at as well. And, you know, they're all out there. And I think that there should be an even playing field.
Absolutely.
I mean, I would agree that, yes, I would like to see that. Obviously, we're all going to be complying with the regulations. I do think it should be lowered. I think 1 pound is just... doesn't really mean anything, but, you know, obviously it does put some, you know, some emphasis on other people trying to get into it. I don't really believe that someone that's producing even 100 pounds out of their home garage, they're really not going to be putting much out there. I'm sure there's a basic test that could be done to prove that, but, you know, I mean, anybody who's, you know, I would say, you know, the 100 to 1,000 pounds or something a year, you know, I think that's more of a realistic number that would allow, like, policy not to wrap other small little industries that are not a big effect on emissions that might get wrapped into this as other rulemaking processes are starting here.
And I don't disagree with that, Abe. I was just pushing the pendulum.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, we're biased here, too. I mean, obviously, we're trying to protect our businesses and, you know, these costs, especially for Tier 1 manufacturers. I mean, these costs are 10-20% of our annual, you know, revenue. You know, I mean, these are huge, huge impacts to us.
Or more.
Yeah. And it, I mean, and it's amazing that any one of us could even do this without actually going bankrupt. And I think that's part of why this really means a lot to us, and that's why it's being brought up, is because it is worrisome to see that there's these other little manufacturers out there actually affecting our business, and especially while we're sort of down waiting for our pollution control device to be installed.
So speaking as a neighbor, I'd be comfortable with nobody having any cadmium in their garage ever, so 1 pound is fine with me as a threshold, and certainly this should apply statewide, and not only because of my health and safety concerns, but also because I am concerned that you guys are trying to do the right thing, and to have you be undercut by people who are doing the wrong thing would be really a disappointing outcome for this process.
Is there anything there, Eric, that you might want to add towards that as well? Is there anything that you guys feel that might be obviously your process is so different.
I would agree that the statewide applicability makes sense. A lower threshold also seems reasonable. As Paul pointed out, there's lasers, people doing ceramics that are using similar items as people that are glass blowers. I think that there has to be a deliberate process of deciding which industries or which users are applicable. And at a certain point, somebody has to draw a line somewhere. I understand that the lower threshold makes sense. I just want to make sure that when you're designing the scope of this, that you're aware that there's some people that may be doing other activities that are somehow affected by that.
People casting lead, casting bronze, casting brass in their garage.
Right. There's other industries that use similar materials that just are not colored art glass manufacturers.
That's the point I was trying to make.
And you know. Not to get on a tangent, but OSHA has a nice process of having a consulting branch as well as an enforcement branch that allows for people, manufacturers, to go and invite OSHA to come in and have them evaluate the situation and propose ways to address compliance concerns and to bring things in line with the regulations, and to do so in a manner that is not going to trigger fines and penalties, as long as the person takes action in a timely manner. It would be interesting if DEQ could incorporate something along the same line, where there's an opportunity for people that may be in a gray area could ask for a consultation process to determine what they have to do.
Wow, that's an excellent idea. We make use of we have OSHA involuntarily 2-3 times a year for exactly the consults you're talking about, and have for years. It never occurred to me to suggest maybe DQ it. I think that's an excellent idea.
Actually, we do have a small business ombudsman at DEQ that does more consulting and advising than enforcing. So we do have that as part of, it's paid for by Title V fees. So the big guys, part of their fees go to this person, the small business owner.
Interesting. Send them our way.
I'll make sure he's got a bigger part of the website.
Yeah. He's about to get a call from everybody.
Actually, I have a question for you now. So if we drop the threshold, you know, these glass blowers that you mentioned, I mean, do we want to regulate your nephew?
I mean, I would think that that's probably the complicated part in that of, you know, obviously artists are using pounds and pounds of our products, right? I mean, we have artists, I'm sure all three of us, including Bullseye and Euroboros, they have artists that just live right here in Portland, stop by, pick up 5, 10 pounds, 20 pounds of glass, and they're using that in their shop. Maybe it's used on a span of, you know, 8-10 months or whatever, but I think maybe that would be something that, you know, I mean, I know I've talked to some of the glass artists in town here of actually asking, can I have our environmental consultants come over and actually do an air test at your facility so we can actually have some data to share with potentially DEQ? Because like I said, I already know right now in Portland alone, two glass companies in question that are just glass blowers, you know, they're just a small garage shop that have been semi-investigated by DEQ and neighbors. I'm sure Amanda knows of the two as well, Paul and Al might as well, but I know they're, you know, these are just glass shops, so I don't know how you'd identify that. I mean, obviously, I think it would come down to furnaces. You know, if someone's actually melting glass in a furnace instead of someone who's actually blowing glass. Obviously, the soft glass industry, so, you know, tier one right now is more silicate glass, tier two is soda lime glass. I would think that there's definitely a difference between the processes of use of a furnace, right?
I think this is where it gets really, really complicated, and it's beyond the scope of this meeting to get into that, because you have people who are just melting cullet, which is pre-made glass, clear glass, and then they'll buy a rod of colored glass and take a chip of it, warm it up, and then roll their glass in it, and that's the way they color. They're not actually melting color, and the clear may not have any HAPS materials in it or a very small amount that is unmeasurable because it's already pre-made. And, you know, it would be very difficult to write a rule that would encompass all the very different iterations of glass shops. I mean, people use bullseye glass for slumping, for example, and they're not bringing it up to a full melt usually, but they're heating colored glass up and slumping it into a fuse, into a mold. You know, you would want to make sure that you don't capture those people, or if you do capture those people, you want to have a good reason for doing it. But, you know, all these things have to be thought about. And then, you know, we have lamp workers that our three companies use that are taking colored glass and heating it up in a torch flame and making artwork out of it. They're melting the glass technically, but it's not in a furnace. And it's a very, very small amount. And we always recommend people have adequate ventilation, and there's probably not enough to even measure coming off of it, but nonetheless, it is melting glass, so the language of any kind of a rule that you write has to be very carefully thought out, and you would have to, you know, have a lot of knowledge about the industry in order to do it.
There may be a way to work in wording about a phase change of the glass from the solid to the softer state and back to a solid state versus doing something from batch.
Right. Well, I agree with all of these difficulties or challenges in putting a rule together. My hope is that if we don't see applicability broadened and the level down, these conversations aren't going to happen at all. We won't address these things as difficult as they are. My hope is that if we can expand applicability, lower the threshold, that DEQ would maybe it's a different rule process after this one, right, potentially. I don't know. But the DEQ would pull together an advisory committee that was broad-based, had glass scientists on that committee, a variety of different types of people, because to the points that are being made here, you may see us as one, you know, sort of homogeneous industry, but the differences are huge, huge in processes, in all aspects of things across our industry. And it's those differences that result in, I think, a number of these challenges that are being referred to. So I'm not at all deluded into thinking that the suggestion that I made is simple. I actually made it because it's not simple, but I think that the discussion needs to happen ultimately.
Is there a possibility of DEQ extending the temporary rules before permanent rules, or is it
no?
Okay.
They expire after 180 days.
Yep.
That's
they're common.
Yeah.
So that's why we're doing this.
Yes. Understand.
Okay. I just want to go on the record saying I think it'll have a significant adverse impact, and that I think that significant adverse economic impact can be reduced by dropping the threshold and expanding the geography statewide. I might be more in Abe's camp, though, on the what is the threshold.
Yeah.
You know, is it 100 pounds? Is it 1,000 pounds? And,
I mean, we got to be realistic.
You know,
I think
that's something that industry and agency can probably figure out what makes more sense.
Well, it might be on the higher number as well to allow that, you know, to not create all those sort of uncertain things where you're going, okay, no artist, at least in Tier 1, is going to be using over 100 pounds of grass in their studio, right? But someone who's manufacturing it, right? So, and I know that what Alice said was just, you know, probably just off the cuff saying 1 pound, just like I would say a 5 or 10. But, I mean, maybe that is a way to say, hey, 100 pounds, I mean, we all know our customers. We've been doing this forever. There's very few customers out there that can be using more than 50 or 100 pounds of glass in a year.
I think that there's a distinction between manufacturing, where you're taking disparate materials and creating something out of that, versus users of your products that would be consuming that as an artist making something.
Yeah,
I think one of the ways this threshold could be considered as well is thinking about what do different production volumes turn into from a revenue standpoint. Somebody's not gonna, if the threshold was 50 pounds or 100 pounds, right? Nobody's gonna get into that as a commercial exercise, right? They're not gonna make enough money off of that, right? Is it 1,000 pounds? Is that where it gets interesting for one person to do this in a couple of pots in their garage and make 1,000 pounds in a year and turn that into money from a commercially, you know, interesting perspective?
How much can you sell a pound of glass for? So I mean, like, what is
it? Really,
how much are you gonna buy?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, which colors?
If you were making 1,000 pounds of glass, like realistically, what
retail
is the range of revenue options that someone that level would have?
Retail is gonna be anywhere from like $50 to $40 to $100 a pound, really, and that's retail.
Mm-hmm.
I know for my business, we are specifically a wholesale manufacturer, so most of the time we're giving, you know, cutting that in half, and that's really what we actually get by the end of the day. I know that the other two, you know, tier one manufacturers have, you know, some form of their sales that are going direct retail and some that are wholesale. I obviously have no clue what the percentage is or anything like that, but, you know, you can tell if someone's selling, you know, 1,000 pounds of glass a year and they're selling for $60 to $80 a pound.
Yeah.
I mean, there's $100,000 up, you know, real quick.
Yeah.
And if you got six or seven of those, all of a sudden, you know, we got these companies that are making anywhere from $2 to $5 million a year. You know, all of a sudden, you know, that's a pretty big impact on us.
But it's not all profit, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Very expensive to make. But again, you know, how are you going to police this? You know, I mean, how do you know if somebody's making 100 pounds or 1,000 pounds?
Well, I know for a fact that the EPA has everyone, at least everyone I know of in our industry, the EPA has everyone who's out there actually doing some form of manufacturing that I know of personally.
In the state or in the country?
In the U.S., yep. And I know that just from a phone call that I've had with them multiple times about actually identifying.
And that's the Oregon?
Seattle EPA, Kate McClintock.
Region 10.
Yep.
Region 10.
Yep.
Okay. So I want to do a time check here.
Yep.
So in the agenda, I want to leave the last 20 minutes for questions from the audience, if there are questions. Was there anything else that you guys wanted to say for that?
No, I think... Nope.
Thanks for having us back a second time. I think that
it
was a very rich conversation, and appreciate that we had the opportunity to have this, because I think we're in a much better place now than we were at the end of the first conversation.
Yeah, and I'm glad that we were able to get Bullseye as well involved.
Yeah,
because obviously this is, you know, most of it did start there, and you know, giving them an opportunity to speak their part, I think, is a key part to this committee as well.
Okay. Great. So I think I'll unmute the phone at this point, see if they have questions. And maybe, but maybe first we could take questions or comments from the audience here. I encourage you, if possible, if you have questions that relate to the discussion here or the fiscal analysis, to maybe make those first. Does anyone here in the audience have a question or a comment they want to make right now?
I would like to make one.
So you could please state your name and then...
Cindy Young. I'm a neighbor of Bullseye and also a member of EPAC. And I really like where this conversation has gone. And I believe that, for me anyway, I don't want to just take care of the problem in my neighborhood. And that's why I chose to become a member of EPAC. This is something that should be, at the very least, statewide and should be larger, in my opinion. This is... as far as health, I'm hoping that maybe eventually we could, you know, concerning China or any of the other places, that we could look at these kinds of issues that affects health, environment, and those kind of things, and do what we need to do at a federal level to keep that from coming in. But until that happens, I mean, the size of the poundage of glass, I think that's a great idea, but I appreciate you all doing this. You're doing a great job. I just would ask, because I am affected with this, and I do have a child that has been affected by pollutants, please consider the health risks and make that be a big part of what we do here, because hopefully this, like I said, can be statewide and perhaps even all over. So thank you.
Okay. I think I might take two more questions from the audience here.
Yeah, hi, Dan Forbes with the Port of Mercury. A correction, that 12.5% originated in a Bullseye press release, their price increase. But my question, just to make sure I have this correctly, and I guess this perhaps is to you, Joe. Under either DEQ rules or 6S rules, your boroughs will have one baghouse, and they've committed to that?
That's my understanding, yeah.
Okay. And an adjunct to that, it's unknown at this point how many baghouses the Bullseye will have. Can I ask Mr. Durin directly? That's still to be determined. Is that correct?
We have submitted several notices of intent to construct to DEQ that currently covers the addition of four bag houses at this point in time.
That will be brought online sort of serially as they're available.
We're working on installation of all of those units currently. Some processes are underway. The latest approval notice was just officially given, so we are not officially commencing work, but the engineering study has been done. And the initial payment has been made to commence work.
And lastly, your boroughs has declined participation in this committee?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, they were offered to be able to say what they decided. Okay. So I'm thinking I might take one more question from the audience and then offer to the, if there are folks on the phone, if they have questions. Does anyone else in the audience have a question? Okay. So I'll unmute the phone, then we can, I don't know actually if there's anyone there, but let's find out.
Our friend.
Yeah, there you go.
All participants are now in interactive talk mode.
Is there anyone there on the phone who has a question or a comment?
One more time.
There are people out here, but I don't think anybody has any questions.
Okay. Okay. So maybe one last chance if anyone in the audience here or on the phone wants to ask a question before we end the meeting. Okay.
I would like to ask another, if I may. I'm confused by the statement that HAP chemicals are very easy to obtain, and that I've been told that you order certain things, even lead, for instance, that attracts OSHA attention, and that and I'm willing to be corrected here.
That's completely incorrect. So you can go to any pottery supply, any raw material supplying company, and order any of these raw materials with no regulation. Maybe the companies that are actually supplying these materials are not following some form of a regulation that they're supposed to be, but at least from I know my experience, and I'm sure everyone else would concur here, that cadmium, lead, arsenic, antimony, nickel, I mean, you can buy this stuff anywhere with no, I mean, even shipping it from China to here, everything.
Some of them are available just walking into a retail outlet in the Greater Portland area.
Yeah.
They don't know who you are. You walk in, buy it, walk out. It's not difficult to get any of these materials.
There's a few that are more difficult than others.
There are a few that are more difficult than others. But even the ones, even I think you'd agree, Paul, even the ones that are more difficult are not difficult at all to the level of being prohibitive. If somebody wanted to melt something in their garage, they could get it.
Yeah,
no question.
Yeah.
There's really no limits, at least from our understanding of those type of metal halves that are in question here.
I learned something so fascinating today. Thank you, Yvette.
Scary, but fascinating.
Right?
Okay, well, let's go ahead and close the meeting. I really want to thank all of the members of the committee for being here, taking time out of your day. This has been really helpful for me. It sounds like hopefully also for you, and definitely helpful for the rulemaking process and then the public and the CPC when they see the information that we've been able to
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.